Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our reviews editor, Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
Hello. So this week we are chatting to one of the stars and the writer of Disney's 100th anniversary flick, Wish. That's Chris Pine and Jennifer Lee. Plus, we're rating that as well as Joanna Hogg's latest team up with Tilda Swinton, The Eternal Daughter, and Deepfake Doc, Another Body. But before we do that, Matthew, what else have you been up to this week?
Well, I saw a very good film a couple of days ago, which isn't actually coming out till next year. Alexander Payne's The Holdovers. Absolutely terrific. But it's so Christmassy. It really kind of captures Christmas in all its ups and downs. But it's not out until January, which seems a bit...
Are you questioning their release decisions there? Well, think it should have been out earlier?
I don't know how people are going to feel seeing it after Christmas. I mean, you know, a great film is not just for Christmas, but it feels like it really should have found a December slot. But anyway, yeah, I thought that was fantastic. One of his best. Absolutely. Really enjoyed that.
We will be reviewing that on a future podcast. Last night, I went to a Wish Christmas party at Claridge's, which was very swishy.
Wow.
Christmas tree up, carol singers in. It felt very... very much like the season is here. We've not even got through Thanksgiving yet, Matthew. And we're already bang up for Christmas. The lights are up in the street. I'm a bit of a grumble duke about this. I don't love Christmas. I find it like just over-egged. Eggnogged, if you will. Why do we all go bananas for Christmas? I don't understand it. It's the same every year. Yeah. I need to switch it up and go have Christmas on a beach or something, I think. For me to really enjoy it. But I'm a bit of a Scrooge, but I have to say that the Wish team did sort of warm my heart. They had these singers in singing a cappella, the song that has lived rent-free in my head since I heard it in that film. And so now ensuring it's never going away ever. That Wish song is there for life. That's what's in there. So very, very nice. Shall we get on to Wish then? We are talking about it. It's out this week. So it's time for some magic dust now.
Once upon a time stood Rosas, a most magical kingdom, founded by a king with the power to grant wishes.
You are their handsomest, most beloved king.
You're right. I am a handsome king.
I'm so nervous, I think I'm going to explode.
My best friend, the king's apprentice.
Is my mouth drooping?
I feel like it's drooping.
Asha, come with me. The wishes of Rosas.
Whoa.
People give their wishes to me, and I grant the wishes I am sure are good for Rosas.
Some of these will never be granted.
Not some, most.
They deserve more than...
I decide what everyone deserves.
So this is Wish, the story of Asha, played by Ariana DeBose, a teen with a dream, which is to work for her kingdom's king, played by Chris Pine. But what if she discovers the magical kingdom of Rosas isn't fair or as wonderful as she thought? Well, then you have to wish upon a star, don't you? Before we chat about that film, let's hear what Chris Pine and Jennifer Lee had to say about this 100th anniversary project when Molly Edwards sat down to talk to them earlier this week.
What are you hiding?
Oh, nothing.
Life is to be lived.
And nobody.
What is going on in there?
Okay, ladies.
Your wings can't fly, but your voices can!
I just wanted to start by asking about the film's place in Disney's 100th anniversary celebrations. It's a very special film. So why was this the right story to tell for this huge milestone?
Yeah, well, we knew we wanted to, all of the artists at the studio wanted to pay homage to the legacy that, you know, we've all gotten to inherit in a way, but we also grew up on. And so we wanted it to be a celebration of those original fairy tales and musicals and beautiful watercolor style. But we wanted to make sure, you know, Walt would say, what are you doing new? So we made an all new, brand new original fairy tale. But we wanted to be something that we felt was connected to our legacy emotionally for us. And recognizing how important the notion of wishing is in Disney's legacy. And when we first started talking about it, it seemed so simple, but that true wish, you know, that drives your heart is one of the most important things we do as humans to affect our world and to make great innovations and to improve each other's lives and to complicate each other's lives. And so it started to get very exciting for me that we could look at wishing in a very different way, which is in the most active way, with all its vulnerability and all its power.
And the film also brings back like the traditional Disney villain with Chris Pine, who's so fun in the film. I loved it. So were you kind of aware of like the wider conversation about people really wanted the Disney villain comeback?
We always say we can't sort of get prescriptive from outside in because we can't build character that way. But I will say, for a lot of us at the studio, we had had a really fun decade, I'd say, of really exploring different kinds of antagonism and villains, because in the world, it's not always easy to identify those villains. And so it was fun for a while to be playing with that. As a writer, too, you always want to do something you've never done. And I had never had that opportunity to work on a real, like, classic villain. And it's a bit daunting and quite exciting to get to do it. And really saying, in this case, we really wanted to be able to celebrate that classic villain, but also, what our audiences today want in the villain? And it is the more complex individual. And they want to see him at his best and understand his philosophy, and maybe even believe it, like Anisha does. And then for me to get to play with how you, every time he's tested, you see him make the choices that lead him. That was really fun to do, and it was a little different, I think, from what we had in the canon. So we're always kind of saying, like, we want to celebrate it, but we also want to find a way to try something new, and because that always excites us.
And I loved all the Easter eggs and like how they sort of celebrate Disney's history. And they're a lot of fun to spot. There are some that are like quite obvious, some that are hidden away. Yeah. So I have to ask, like, is this like, are we looking at like a Disney multiverse? Or is this just like some fun?
I know. Actually, it's other people have asked that question. And I think the concept of a Disney multiverse has come up so many times from people. Just all the little hints, you know, Rapunzel and Frozen and things like that. We always love to play with that amongst ourselves too. We talk about things like that. So this, we said, look, let's just have some fun. I'm sure someone's going to do a map and the logic doesn't pan out in terms of when things were. I totally get that. But at the same time, it was just really fun. Almost not take stuff too seriously and acknowledge that this is really all of us. With the Easter eggs, to me, it was more about not even like a multi-universe, but more about what we all share, because that's the part that I love most about Disney, is it's all of ours, and we all grew up on it. It's 100 years old, which means it's older than most of us, but it's something that we share that is positive, and it brings us together. And so to just have those nods, and then I'm traveling the world, and I'm sitting in audiences where we're connecting with the same things, and we didn't grow up anywhere near each other, and in completely different lives. And that's something that in this world right now feels more rare than, you know, maybe it could. So I think we really wanted to say, let's celebrate the multiverse of us actually carrying these memories. So we could start there, and the rest, I'm sure everyone will tell us what we got right or wrong. And my favorite one's actually the one that comes at the very end after the credits are done. That's my favorite one for sure. It's one we talked about, and it never felt organic, but something we just thought would be lovely. And so they surprised me with it, actually, and I got emotional.
And you mentioned Frozen. I did want to ask you about Frozen 3, because we've just heard very excitingly from Bob Iger that there might even be a Frozen 4. So, like, does that mean, are you sort of conceiving Frozen 3 as, like, part of a larger narrative that's going to connect to a fourth film, or are they kind of, like, separate?
I'm being careful, because not to spoil anything, but more to say, really what it comes down to is we're really excited about where they're going, and we just have a lot of story to tell with that direction we're going in. So I think, you know, in my head, there may be enough for two, but I'm really, really loving where working with the team and where they're going.
And, you know, still speaking of Frozen, you know, the film is coming up to its 10th anniversary very soon. And it's such a cultural, like, phenomenon. So, like, looking back a decade later, especially with Wish, as we're thinking about 100 years, sort of like, how do you view, like, Frozen's legacy as a film?
Wow, that's a great question. No one's quite asked me that. I think what I love about Frozen, I think it was unexpected for all of us. And we went into it the way we go into every story, which is, you know, really from character out. And the fact that it became something special, and that these sisters, is that like that it really at the core is two sisters, I think for a lot of us was just very exciting about new kinds, who are those protagonists that we can tell these great stories of women, particularly women who are on each other's side, not against each other. That was really exciting that people responded to it. So I think in some ways, Frozen to me has encouraged us to keep telling different kinds of stories of different kinds of heroes. And I think there wouldn't be Asha without Anna and Elsa, and this young woman who is her own hero and she has incredible courage, and what she has is one of the most generous wishes in our legacy. And I think that spirit of deciding who is she and where can she go for me, comes off of all that I learned on Frozen.
Speaking about like the 100 years of celebrations and everything and Wish's role in that, you're also like Disney Animation's chief creative officer. So I was wondering, like, in that role, how are you kind of seeing Disney moving forward into what you must hope is like the next 100 years? Yeah. But like in the short term, what do you think is kind of like the direction that you're hoping to go in?
Yeah, well, I think we're starting to see it with a couple of things. You know, Fawn Roosenthorne, this is her first film. She's the second woman to direct, so I'm so excited for her. And Julia Michaels, who is the youngest songwriter we've had to write all the songs of a film. I guess the equation is it's the new generation. That's the thing. I think that I've had the pleasure of 13 years now with Disney, and I think the most important thing I can do is all, when I got there, I had incredible mentors who taught me about the Disney musical and that structure and how to study Howard Ashman and that kind of way that I was taught and all the tools that I got, and that I'm giving those tools to the next generation while also helping them bring their very unique voice forward, because it's very different. You know, I do see that difference. I think it's part of how Disney evolves is when you're getting that next generation's voice, but with you're setting them up for success, you know.
You do have like the extensive experience at Disney. So I was wondering, was there anything about making Wish that was like an unexpected challenge or something you'd never really encountered before in your time?
I mean, I think every single one of these, every single one, there's never one that's easier than the others. Never. They're always equally challenging. I think what was fun for me is to do something new after Frozen that was a completely different set of characters and worlds. I think the hardest part was, to be honest, was wishing I could be with the team all the time. Because you do, what I've had the pleasure of is once I'm on a film, I'm completely immersed in that film. And this, in the chief creative officer role, my job is really to help those teams and to come in and help them bring their vision forward. And so you don't get to fully be immersed. And so I think the greatest challenge for me was probably that. And there's like a bittersweetness to it, but at the same time, because it was a lot of the folks I'd worked with so closely, there's a lot of trust.
You know, Magnifico is kind of the first traditional villain that we've seen from Disney in quite a while. And there are so many iconic Disney villains from the past 100 years. So I was wondering, like, how did you make sure that you made your mark as Magnifico?
It really wasn't up to me. It was up to Jennifer and Chris and Fawn, the directors and writers of the project. And they gave me a really fun character to play. And I'm not as off book on Disney villains as some other people might be. So I felt all the liberty in the world to go explore and have fun.
And of course, you have like the big villain song, This Is the Thanks I Get, which is just great. It's like, it's really funny, but it's also quite scary. So I was wondering, like, how was it recording that and like striking that balance between like the funny part and then the like really intimidating, like evil part?
That was Ben and Julia. They were the writers and composers of the music. I spent a lot of time working with them, and it was about finessing the lines and the words and the intent and the emotion behind it. And I really give credit. I felt like I was just there taking direction from people, and the direction was great. So I just tried to make it happen.
Kind of all great villains. Magnifico kind of thinks he's doing the right thing, but he's going about it in just like such an evil way by the end. So I was wondering, like, what did you kind of make of that sort of duality? Because it makes him very interesting as we go on through the story.
Well, I had a different take. I don't really think he had any good intent at all, really. I think he was just trying to steal people's wishes in order to make himself more powerful. So but I'm glad that you see the complexity in the character. And that's always fun to have a bad guy that you can kind of empathize with.
Maybe I was just tricked by him at the beginning when he was saying he wanted to take care of them all.
Successful then, huh?
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. And I also really love like Usher and Magnifico have like this very interesting dynamic. They have that like lovely duet together. And then, you know, it gets obviously very dark as we go on. So like, what was it like sort of recording that? And did you get to record that duet with Ariana DeBose?
No, we didn't record together, unfortunately. This was really, again, all up to Jennifer and Chris and Fawn, who are our directors and writers, to make sure that the arc of the both characters' stories made sense. And when they converged, led to, you know, quite a, you know, good drama.
And I did also want to ask you about another film of yours that came out this year that I absolutely loved. I'm talking about Dungeons and Dragons. I was wondering, like, have you heard anything about a sequel?
I've heard some rumors about it, but I don't know anything yet. But I feel pretty confident that it may happen.
Oh, amazing news. And you'd be happy to come back?
Absolutely.
Great. Love it. Looking forward to that, definitely. And, you know, we're talking about like Wish is like part of the Disney legacy, and you've talked about like the villain legacy. But I was wondering, like, as you approached this role, were you thinking a lot about that? Like, this is a huge part of Disney's 100th celebrations. Did you feel any like responsibility? Were you thinking about that at all? Or were you just sort of having fun, focused on the character?
I was having fun, focused on the character. There's not much you can do worrying about trying to do a good job. People will either like it or not. The internet is such a awful place that I'm sure many awful things will be said about how we, et cetera, et cetera. But you're trying to do good by the kids who are wanting to go in and forget their world and jump into a world full of awe and wonder and love and all the good feels that Disney has been known to do. And for my own part, having grown up watching, as we all have, if anyone is alive on planet Earth, I'm sure they have a Disney memory somewhere in their brain. To be asked to be a part of that legacy is a great honor.
So that was Chris Pine talking Dungeons and Dragons 2, as well as other things, and Jennifer Lee on Wish. Matthew, I did a little log line at the beginning there.
Yeah.
But obviously, it's more than just Asha understanding that the world isn't as fair as she thought. And it's sort of about her sort of coming of age of understanding that. It's also about other things, isn't it? Grief, yeah. Friendship, and that sort of thing. So give us a little bit more about what this film goes into.
Well, yeah. So like you said, she apprentices herself to the ruler of the kingdom, this sorcerer, Magnifico. But then, yes, it dawns on her that he's actually has a more sinister purpose. He's not as benevolent as he seems. It seems like he is controlling the populace, and it's all centered on the populace's wishes. So she basically sets out on a mission to liberate these wishes via a falling star. And this is obviously a key symbol for Disney. It's all to do with When You Wish Upon a Star, their signature tune, which has been around since Pinocchio. So the star plays this very key role. And there's a talking animal sidekick as well, which is classic Disney.
Yeah.
And so it basically boils down to this battle of wills between the young, kind of idealistic Asha and then the more controlling, patriarchal Magnifico.
Including like singing mushrooms and a reference to Bambi and so many little Disney Easter eggs in this because Disney is 100 years old this year. And so this film is, for me, a strange corporate ad. It tries to have its cake and eat it. It wants to celebrate all of the Disney-ness of it whilst also being a great film. And for me, I'm not sure it manages that. Did you like it?
No, I was really disappointed. I didn't dislike it, but yeah, this is alongside Indiana Jones. I have to say it's one of the biggest disappointments of the year for me, because I was very much looking forward to it, and especially as it's got Chris Buck co-directs, Jennifer Lee co-wrote it, and they obviously the powerhouses behind Frozen, and Jennifer Lee is now kind of the figurehead of Disney animation. So yeah, I was really looking forward to it. I just remember when Tangled came out, that was their 50th Disney animation, and that felt like they put everything into that, and that was such a great film.
I love so Tangled.
It's so good. I was kind of expecting the same from this, as it's their centenary film. I mean, it's sort of pleasant enough. I wasn't bored as such, but I really struggled to find a kind of standout moment in it. I was sort of reflecting on it afterwards. Mm. You know, it's kind of lightly amusing, but not hilarious. The songs are pleasant, but I didn't find any of them especially memorable. It's not always clear what the stakes are. It's only really Asha and Magnifico I found memorable characters, and maybe the goat as well, Valentino, who's voiced by Alan Tudyk. I mean, that's a nice gag when he finds his voice.
He's like, I didn't know it would be so low.
Yeah. I mean, that's probably the best bit.
I agree. When you think how much love and time has gone into this, and, you know, we've been going and hearing Jennifer Lee talk about this project for years now, you think we've got this excellent team. Why is it not more funny? Why is it not smarter? Why is it not more aware of the world outside itself? And for some people, that probably is the attraction. This is a very self-contained world. It's diverse. You're seeing a lot of diversity on screen there in this kingdom. But for me, when you've had something like Spider-Verse and things like that, that have elevated animation, not just the look of it. I mean, the look of this is beautiful. It's that old painterly style that you might expect from Snow White and early Disney things. It looks gorgeous. But it just isn't as heartfelt as Frozen, which we have to compare it to because it's the same team And it isn't as smart as something like Spider-Verse and as self-aware. So it falls into this sort of cute arena for me that is good for kids and not doesn't really elevate it to being a sort of four quadrant movie for me. I think kids will like this and enjoy the talking animals, and Disney fans who are hardcore Disney fans will love picking out all the Easter eggs. But I don't think parents are going to walk away going, God, I want to see that again, which is what did happen with Frozen. Yeah. You know, it wasn't just the kids that were beguiled by that. Frozen, absolutely everybody was enchanted. And that's not to say that Ariana DeBose isn't a delightful presence. Her voice work in this, just her speaking voice as well as her singing is delightful.
Oh, yeah.
There is one song, I disagree with you, there is a power ballad that is incredibly catchy, but it's not a Frozen. And I just kept comparing the two. I couldn't help it. Yeah, so for me, again, like you, bit of a disappointment.
I thought Chris Pine was very good, and it kind of reminded me of Don't Worry, Darling, that, you know, you've got this kind of toxic patriarch who thinks he knows best. And
I'm not sure Chris Pine would want to be reminded of that.
But no, possibly not, given that film's history.
Yeah.
But it did kind of remind me of that it was like that with animation. But it really feels like it could have pushed further in terms of what it was trying to address in terms of, you know, authority controlling people and people rebelling and taking control of their own wishes and destinies and aspirations. But yeah, it just all felt just a bit lightweight, really. Didn't go far enough.
Did you like Star, the little sort of squashy, effervescent thing that is this sort of non-speaking role that floats about?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite sort of cutesy, but it looked like a piece of merchandising, like straight away to me, or a kind of like an animated emoji. I didn't quite warm to it as much as, you know, someone like Olaf from the Frozen movies.
Oh, delightful. Yeah. And, you know, she's a young character as well. There is no romantic lead in this, which I enjoyed. Really? I liked that it was about her really sort of enjoying her friends and also just learning about herself and coming into her own. And there was no boy or girl that focus was on. So I did like that. But I found the rules of this world as well difficult to understand. Like the rules of the giving your wish. And also, like, if you give your wish, then he keeps it and then he will grant it at some point in your life. And Ash's grandfather is 100 years old. Surely at 100, your wish isn't the same as it is when you were 18 or whatever time. You give your wish when you become an adult. I was like, at 18, his wish was to be strumming a guitar and changing people's lives with his music. At 100, it's surely to live for another 100 years. Surely he's not bothered about the guitar at 100. So those sort of things took me out of it. And the fact that I didn't really understand initially why the king kept the dreams and like what he really was doing with them. Yeah. And I didn't feel I had invested in the stakes of this as much as I would with Frozen, where I really was. It was very clear what this is about and who's trying to do what and what the stakes are. This felt quite muddied and sort of indistinct and vague, which is a bit like Star himself. He's indistinct around the edges, and that's how I felt the sort of main thrust of this story was.
Yeah, I felt that really affected the resolution, not being quite clear on what the rules of this universe were. It just seemed like things were just, it was a crisis one minute and then it's all settled the next. I didn't really quite understand what had been achieved, or, you know, didn't feel particularly hard earned at the end there. So that was a big disappointment. And for me, no spoilers, but the end credits was the most enjoyable part for me. I have to say that was the bit that kind of dredged up most emotion watching that. So,
have to say, you have to sit and watch the credits because there is an end credit sequence that may or may not add an extra level of delight or not. It didn't for me. I was like, oh, was that it? So I think we're saying if you have kids that you want to entertain, get them along to this. If you're a Disney fan and everything that they do warms your cockles of your heart, this is probably going to hit that spot. But for everyone else, I think it's probably a bit of a film that you'll watch and never think of again.
Yeah, I felt like the weight of expectations were too much and it just didn't live up to them.
Frozen 3 and 4, I say. Let's get those out. Yeah. Come on, Jennifer Lee and the rest of your team. I think when you're not bogged down by that, trying to fit a centennial and a branding exercise into a story, then I think it's going to fly. And I can't wait for Frozen 3 and 4. Totally here for it. So if you fancy Wish, it is in cinemas on Friday. And, you know, it's worth seeing on a big screen, I think. Don't wait for it to come to Disney Plus. See it on a big screen because that animation is beautiful. Right, time for another daughter wishing for something in this.
Mom, we're here. We'd like to check in, please.
My mother has a relationship with this house. She was here when she was young.
Are we the only people staying here?
I don't know.
There was a sound. I'm sure other people have mentioned it to you. Mom?
That's strange, because nobody else has mentioned anything at all.
So this is The Eternal Daughter, Joanna Hogg's film, re-teaming with somebody she works with a lot, Tilda Swinton, and Tilda times two, because she's playing two roles of a daughter and a mother. Matthew, what's this daughter and mother up to? Where are they going?
Well, they're going off to a little hotel, boarding house in, is it Wales? I think it's Wales.
I don't know that they're ever specific about where it is, but it's a spooky old pile, isn't it?
It really is, yeah. And they're apparently the only guests there. And yeah, like you say, Tilda, she plays both the daughter, Julie, and the mother, Roz, which are the same character names as in The Souvenir, except we had Swinton's own daughter playing the daughter in those, but here she plays the dual role. And they're there, they're celebrating the mother's birthday, and the daughter is asking the mother to kind of reflect on her memories of this place, because this place holds a lot of keys to her past in it. And at the same time, she's prepping a movie. She's trying to write a screenplay, which apparently is she's using these memories to fuel this screenplay. So for the most part, it's a two-hander, but then there are some, every time it gets to nighttime, there's some spooky things going bump in the night. There's lots of fog constantly whirling around. The dog gets spooked by things. They've got a dog with them.
Tilda's own dog, that is, starring. Yeah, that's another Swinton star from that family.
Louis the dog. The concierge is just absolutely brilliantly...
Doesn't care.
DGAF.
Doesn't care.
So yeah, there's not a great deal happens in plot terms. It is kind of them negotiating this relationship and kind of eventually kind of really getting under each other's skins and unlocking things about each other. And there's mysteries to solve. So it's very much a kind of a character and atmosphere driven movie. Yeah, kind of a sort of a step away in some ways from The Souvenir movies and kind of shifting more into sort of horror and ghost stories.
And it's exec produced by Martin Scorsese, so he clearly sees something in this that taps into his love of film. When I saw this, it sort of reminded me of Rebecca in a way, a character in a house that is haunted. But what is it haunted by? Is it real sort of presence, or is it psychological? What's going on? I would call it sort of Rebecca with hot water bottles. There's a lot of hot water bottle filling up in this.
There is a lot.
I reckon if you're watching this and you do feel a chill, you should take a hot water bottle with you, because otherwise you'll be like, oof, I could use one of those every time she's going to get that filled up. But yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because it absolutely fits into her Hogg's new sort of universe that she's creating. Mm. So if you've enjoyed her films and the meta sort of aspect of them, of her stepping outside of her art to show you the process of making the art, which is what these films do, this fully sits in that. But at the same time, it does go into a sort of psychological spookiness that is a step away. And I liked that. I liked that. You know, doors were banging, there was groaning in the night. What was going on? And I actually was really sort of captivated by that. For me, The Souvenir 2, I was bored stupid. This one, I was trying to work out what was going on. And there is a twist that is actually really quite heartfelt when you get to it. So I found that this more emotionally invested me than her previous one. How about you?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely loved the first Souvenir, and I did find the second one a bit of a letdown. Yeah, like you say, a bit too meta. So, I did enjoy this a lot more, just purely for Tilda Swinton. I mean, she's one of my favourite actors, so seeing her double up like that, playing off herself, and she really differentiates the characters. She does it so superbly. Just the kind of the repartee between these two characters when they're talking about very sort of banal things, you know, like fussing over the menu and...
Yeah.
Nice the beetroot salad is and things like that. I mean, Hogg is so brilliant at capturing those kind of moments. So, I very much enjoyed their performances and the concierge, Carly Sophia Davis. She
Yes.
has these lots of she interjects at various points and brings a lot of the humor. And there's some really like classic kind of awkward exchanges that you often get in Joanna Hogg's movies, often around a dinner table. And there's plenty of those there. So yeah, it's very much in her wheelhouse. I enjoyed it a lot. It seems like it's a very personal film for Hogg. I was reading about how it's a lot to do with her own relationship with her mother and also her own fear of the dark, apparently. It's to do with that. It's her sort of working through that. And I feel like that kind of came across and evoking lots of old movies as well, like The Innocents and The Haunting. I thought there were lots of echoes of The Shining. It did remind me of The Shining in various places. So yeah, I can
Yeah.
see why Scorsese was willing
Intrigued.
to back it. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, we talk about Tilda playing against herself. This isn't done with any sort of digital
No.
chicanery. It's literally she's playing in one frame the daughter and in the next frame the mother. So I think it's incredibly clever that they've managed to make that on that lo-fi way, but it feels really immediate. It feels like they're, you know, in the same room. It feels like they're absolutely having a
Definitely.
conversation at all times. So I was really impressed by that. But yeah, as you say, those conversations, it made me want to call my mum when I had finished watching it, because I've definitely sat in a hotel dining room and sort of discussed whether I have that starter, but oh no, should I? And if you would have it, could I have a bite of yours? And the mundaneness and the intimacy of those conversations, I think, were just perfection. Yeah, I mean, I love Joanna Hogg because she is so interested in that banalness of our lives and the interactions that we have and the awkwardness of family. Archipelago is one of my favorites, which is just you've got this family and you love them to death, but God, they annoy you as well. And she really manages to nail that with
Oh
this relationship. You know, mother is delightful, but also a pain in the bum for the daughter, and vice versa. And there's that snippiness that is just perfectly captured. So yeah, I love this. Would you recommend people see this on a big screen?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think for the atmosphere. I mean, yeah, I didn't watch it on a big screen. I felt like I probably would have found it scarier watching it on a big screen with the sort of amped up sound and being in the dark. I think those kind of scary moments would have enveloped me more. I mean, anyway, I did perfectly enjoy it on a small screen, but yeah, I think it does have a sort of cinematic feel to it, despite the fact that it is, you know, very minimalist in a lot of ways.
And the sound design is excellent. And so if you've got a great setup at home for the sound, brilliant. But I do think if you sit in a cinema, in a dark cinema, and there's that creaking, banging window or that weird moaning, it does unsettle you and makes you feel a bit shivery. So I would highly recommend seeing it in the cinema. So if you fancy The Eternal Daughter, it is out in cinemas on Friday. Right. Were you afraid of AI before? Because you'd be very afraid now. It's this.
I was sitting here with my boyfriend and my face popped up on the screen.
And then it kind of hit me what had actually happened.
Deepfake videos, which are manipulated using AI, can make someone appear as though they're saying or doing something that they're not.
Once these images are online, they never truly go away.
The detective that got assigned to the case, he said that it's disgusting what happened, but the person had a right to do it. Like they didn't break any laws.
And then they told me they had closed the case.
This is another body, an exploration of AI and deep fakery. Tell us about it. Who does it center on?
Yeah, this is a documentary about deep fake, specifically deep fake pornography. It centers on a student, Taylor, who discovers that there are deep fake images of her on a porn site. And she also, sort of digging further, she finds out that some of her fellow students have also been targeted in the same way. So she kind of endeavors to find out who has done this, what the legality of it is. So it's very sort of personal on one level. It's her story, but at the same time, it is a kind of an activist call for more legislation around deepfake pornography, because the laws are very kind of baggy at the moment, and it seems like you can essentially get away with this. This perpetrator is allowed to commit these kind of horrific acts of exposing people and humiliating them. Yeah, so it kind of follows her journey and kind of the empathy that she discovers with these other other people who've been victims. It sort of gets into all of that. So yeah, so on the one hand, it is kind of very disturbing and alarming, but at the same time, quite sort of fascinating and obviously very of the moment as well.
All of the strikes, you know, a lot of the discussion over the actor strikes was about AI and the use of your likeness. Yeah. And this is sort of taking that from, like, you know, Tom Cruise doesn't want you to take his face and put it on an ad for whatever. Background artists don't want to be replicated in numerous films. This is going to like down to the level of normal people and how we can have our likeness stolen and the invasion of privacy. And also the weaponizing of sex in this is really interesting, that what's the most humiliating thing you could do to a woman? And that's put her head and likeness onto somebody doing pornography. And it's so realistic, isn't it? The way that they can do it, that really you cannot tell that there's anything dodgy about it at all. It feels exactly like that woman has done that act. And as you say, it is so alarming that when you take this to the police or to a detective, that actually no laws have been broken. You are fully able to do this. And there is no way you can prosecute somebody for it. You can appeal to them to please not do that, but actually you can't prosecute. So it's an interesting film in uncovering that. There is a plot twist. Now, that plot twist really left me with my jaw on the floor. I was not expecting that at all. And it made it even more sinister. But I can see how that could also take you entirely out of that story and think, what am I watching? You've pulled the rug from under me and well done you, but now I'm not invested. How did you feel about it?
Yeah, so the producers themselves, in a bid to protect Taylor's identity or offline identity, they've used deepfake technology as well. So kind of using the tools that the antagonists, if you will, of this film are using. So, yeah, like you say, you are kind of watching this and you're not quite sure exactly what you're seeing. What everything seems to be simulated here. And including when they show clips of the sites themselves, those are apparently all simulated using this technology. So there is a good deal of fakery. And yeah, it is quite disturbing just how realistic it can be. I mean, how it can deceive your eyes so that you don't quite know what you're actually watching, even when the object is to do some good with it, to protect people. But obviously we've reached this level now where you just cannot believe what you're seeing anymore. So
yeah, and that's scary, isn't it?
Yeah.
And in any application, like for people who sort of always decry facts as fake news, this is like, oh my goodness, where can this go? So it is an alarming thing. And I think it does a really good job of frightening you. But ultimately, does it make you want to sympathize with those women? Of course it does. But then the fact that it's playing with your expectations and your sense of what is real, I think muddies the water a little bit in this particular story.
Yeah, so yeah, I suppose to a degree it's duping the viewer. Not obviously not to the same degree that Taylor has been duped, but yeah, there is that sort of implication there. And I think it just shows you this technology can be used for terrible evil, but at the same time it can be used to fight back against that. I mean, it's sort of fighting fire with fire. But yeah, it's such an of the now kind of documentary. I mean, it couldn't have been made literally before now. And the kind of stats it shows about how this is kind of growing exponentially as well, these deep fakes, it just shows that it's going to get a lot worse and more complicated, really, unless this legislation is put in place and people start to fight back a bit more.
Yeah. I mean, it was used, it's called using a face veil, I think it's called. And it has been used in previous films to protect the identities of people who, you know, may die as a result of revealing, you know, things that people in their homeland would not like. It was used in Welcome to Chechnya, you know, to protect the identities of people, you know, revealing their sexuality. It could literally get them killed if they were identified. So, from that point of view, it can be used for good. But yeah, it's something I think this film, you'd have a lot to chat about afterwards. Like, where do you draw the line? When is it okay to use it? And when is it okay not to? And how do we legislate on that? And how do we decide on that? And somebody's idea of what would be a good use of it is very different from somebody else's. And one political side would be very different idea of it than another. And so it's very, very muddy and murky and fascinating and terrifying at the same time. So would you suggest that people see this? Is this, it goes like a thriller. I think it's a good watch. So in terms of entertainment, I think it's good as a documentary. But is it something that people should be going out to see this weekend?
Yeah, well, I was kind of intrigued because, again, I didn't see it on a big screen. I'd wonder how effective the fakery is on a big screen, because watching it on a laptop, it's very convincing. So I was just wondering what it's like to see it on a big screen. I mean, how to what extent, whether perhaps blown up on a big screen, it's not so convincing. So I'd be intrigued by that. Yeah, it's a tricky one because it is, in some ways, it feels like a very sort of vital film. But on the other hand, whether you'd want to go and see it on a Friday or a Saturday night, because it is going to leave you quite chilled
Yeah, I
in a
mean,
bad way.
it's going to put you on a downer, I think, on a Friday night. But yeah, I agree. I watched this on a small screen, and when I knew what I knew at the end, I thought, oh, some of those sequences I saw earlier perhaps were a bit glitchy, and I think my brain was telling me something, but I sort of dismissed them. And I wonder if on a big screen that's more obvious. It would be interesting to see. But yeah, it is an interesting film to go and see if you're not into Star and Talking Goats, and if you're not into mothers and daughters having chats over hot water bottles. It's an interesting collection of films for this week. What's going to be your film of the week, Matthew?
Oh, The Eternal Daughter, I think, quite easily.
Yeah, I agree. I think The Eternal Daughter is, it's a sort of a Trojan horse of a movie. You think nothing's going on, and then by the end, you're like, oh, I think I've processed quite a lot of feelings here. So yeah, it would be The Eternal Daughter for me. Okay, so that's our week this week. A reminder then that if you like this podcast, you can make your life easier by subscribing. Just press that button now and you're all set. Right, before we go, we have time for a listener's question. Greatest garden in cinema. What's the greatest garden that you love?
Perhaps the one in Edward Scissorhands, the
Oh,
topiary.
yeah.
They're so delightful to look at, and consistently through the film. Yeah, they're always kind of amusing and charming. And that's so in Tim Burton's wheelhouse as well. He does that kind of thing so well. So yeah, I think I'd go for
I thought you were going to go for Spirited Away. That's
that.
your sort
Oh
of thing,
yeah.
isn't it? With all
Yeah.
those beautiful flowers.
That's my
Yeah.
number two,
Number
I'll
two.
say.
Okay, cool. My garden is probably Atonement. I love Atonement, and I felt like Saltburn had a lot of that sort of vibe, that heady sort of days of summer where they're lying by their lovely pond and swimming, and there's a fountain in the garden, and it's these beautiful grounds of this stately home. And a lot of the plot drivers happen within that garden that change people's lives and destinies. And so I think that's my garden. But I did enjoy the Saltburn one as well. I'd like to have a field I could lie naked in, or a
That'd be
swimming
awesome.
pond, or a tennis court. I don't have any of those things. I've got enough space to sit with a coffee and a small rickety chair. And I very much like rolling sort of acreage. So one day, one day.
This time, Rodney. This time next year, Rodney.
Yeah, it's on my wish list. Here you go.
Yeah.
There we are. That's what I'm going to wish upon a star for. A garden that's large enough to have a fountain in it. That's my dream. Okay, so on that note, I think we will say goodbye and keep our green fingers to ourselves. We'll be back next week with more. But until then, say goodbye, Matthew.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
I'm wishing on a star. Wishing on a dream to follow what it means. I'm wishing on a star.
So long.